This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
This is the Breakfast Grill, and I'm Wong Xiaoning. This morning, we have Ian Shapiro with us, the CEO of Real Limited. Real, spelled with two L's, stands for Real Equity for All. It is a registered charity in England with a mission to improve the life chances of 100 million people in urban Africa and Asia by 2030. Good morning, Ian. Why does Real focus on affordable housing?
The reason we do what we do is because we recognise that urbanisation is happening at an incredible rate at the moment. And we know that already today, there's 1.6 billion people who don't have adequate housing, adequate shelter. And we know that that's accelerating at an incredible rate. And we know that by 2030, so just 11 years from now, there's going to be over 3 billion people in the same situation. So that number's going to double unless we do something about it. And our feeling is that there's a huge missed opportunity here for people on low incomes, that the little bit of housing response that is happening at the kind of middle income and the upper middle income level and for the high earners. And actually, we want to prove that there's a commercially viable model that can make homes affordable for people at the bottom of the income pyramid. And this means that we can prove that this gets huge social and economic benefits, stimulates economies, creates jobs, improves healthcare, but can be done at the kind of $10,000 a home level. And really, we feel that that's what we need to do to face this global challenge. That's what we need to do to reduce the numbers of people who have inadequate housing and therefore poor healthcare, limited job opportunities, and so on. And that we need to get ahead of that curve and the urbanization can be a massive opportunity rather than a risk for people on low incomes.
Yeah, I noticed in your website, you use the word project partners a lot, and that is a model unique to you. Can you give us an illustration of what you mean by that?
Absolutely. So clearly, what we need to do is we're trying to disrupt markets. We're trying to demonstrate that this model works. And so to do that effectively in any market and when 15 countries in Africa and Asia, you need to have that local expertise, that understanding of the local demographics, of the personalities involved, the local legislation, customs and approaches. So we always work with a partner in country, often perhaps more than one partner in a country, because it's not for us to come in. We have an overarching financial model. We have an overarching set of engineering, sustainable materials, project planning expertise, which are transferable. But we need to work with the experts, with the architects, the urban planners, the policymakers in each country, because that's the only way to make a sustainable difference.
And you also make reference to a sustainable and commercially viable model. How does that work?
So I think, Xiaoning, there's a kind of macro answer, and maybe I should try to start with a personal example and think about it from the individual's perspective. We're not talking about providing a solution to people who live under bridges or live on the streets, and obviously there is a need for that. There is a need for support and systems, but that's not. We're talking about people who presently already live in often very harsh conditions. So if you can imagine, you shut your eyes and you think about someone who's living in a 2 meter by 2 meter concrete floor, no running water, no electricity, a curtain separating them from another family on the other side of the curtain. These people are living in very difficult conditions, but they are still paying. Every month they're paying rent, and they may be paying it to an unscrupulous landlord or someone who is using the funds in a different way. But these are people who perhaps work in the informal economy, perhaps are selling donuts or food in local markets, or working as a carpenter on a ad hoc basis, or a labourer. But they are finding the money as a household every month to pay for their rent. And actually, what we're trying to do is put in patient capital. So we're going to trust and invest in those people and be confident that they will repay. And so instead of living in that concreted floor with no electricity, no running water, and a curtain separating two tiny rooms from each other, we can move people into a two-bedroom home with running water and electricity that allows girls and children to study, to go to toilet safely at night, to have a better quality of healthcare. But actually, they can be paying the same amount for a mortgage or a rent, but to in a very safe, sanitary, stable condition that gives them security, creates an asset for that family. So perhaps over 7 or 10 years, they can own the home themselves. But it also gives them this security and this certainty and the ability to move into the formal banking system.
So in a way, you're affording them an opportunity to step onto the property ladder.
Absolutely. But partly because it gives them that asset. So moving them into the formal system, what we're doing is working with people who actually already do incredible cash flow management. They may not be using spreadsheets and complicated apps and so forth for how they manage their finances, but these are people who are already paying rent. But what we're doing is providing patient capital, which takes that sort of medium to long-term risk on them. And we know the repayment rates are incredibly high. So in Nepal, for example, we do this with people in the bottom 40% of the income pyramid, so some quite vulnerable people. We're working with the formal banking sector because we're providing a guarantee to the bank that we will guarantee the repayments. The banks will tell you, working with 5 of the mainstream banks, very impressive organizations, that their repayment rates are the best for this product across their whole suite. They're well above 99% repayment rates. So this is for the poorest people in Nepal. So quite incredible what you can do to create that potential, that sense of potential for people if you are prepared to take that patient capital investment at the beginning.
And Ian, what about the macro model you mentioned earlier?
Well, so what I wanted to say exactly is that this model, that all sounds nice, and you think, well, okay, how does it pay for itself? Well, actually, we can demonstrate that you can get commercial or sub-commercial returns from this on a medium-term basis. So clearly, some people move into the real estate sector, and they might be looking in volatile markets for a 20% return or those 15 to 25% return on investment. If people are looking for those numbers, then we're not the people to work with because we can't deliver that. But we have confidently shown, we've been in existence for 30 years, we can confidently show, depending on the market, a 2 to 7% return over a 7 to 10 year period. That's dealing with all of the currency speculation issues, the property increase in prices, all of that factored in, the cost of living. And so what we can show is that this is not only commercially viable, but if you look at the health benefits, the jobs delivered, the improvement in children's education and so on, that investors that are looking for both a commercial return and a development impact, a public policy, a social good return as well, this is an incredibly valuable investment.
But Ian, I just want to know, like in terms of the funding, from what I gather, you are mainly funded by the Department for International Development, which is a UK agency, and then the Swedish International Development Cooperation Agency, right?
That's correct.
How much do they contribute to your overall funding? Or do you currently now look for private investors?
So two answers to that. I mean, so historically, that's correct that we have been getting funding from the UK's Department for International Development and the Swedish International Development Agency. And they have been providing us grant financing, which we then on loan and on invest. So we have a mixture of debt, equity, guarantees, depending on the context. But at the moment, we're in advanced discussions with a range of other investors from philanthropic foundations to social impact investors to soft investors and some at the more commercial end. We believe that we've now got the track record that shows that this can be scaled up very, very significantly, and therefore can take a whole set of blended investment. We have had grant finance at this point, but because we've demonstrated the success of the revolving model, we're confident of managing impact investment as well.
Because when I read your annual report, one of the risks is that you haven't secured phase three of your funding from DVID and SIDA, right? So I was wondering what will happen if you don't get the grant funding. How much of this private investment have you secured to continue with your good work?
So this issue has accelerated up the agenda. I think there's a recognition now in a way that when we've been working on these issues for 30 years, that even 5 years ago, there wasn't this sense of commitment and causing. So if you look at take Pakistan, for example, with Imran Khan has come in and he's made this one of his top priorities to build 5 million affordable homes. And you see that across a whole range of countries, a recognition that affordable housing can be the key to breaking poverty cycles, unlocking opportunities for people on low incomes, securing better tax, GDP, revenue, and jobs and opportunities. So what does that mean for us? Is it means that there's very few people operating in this space at the low income level, so at the kind of $10,000 a home level, who have demonstrated this is commercially viable. And we are such an organization. And as such, there's a huge number of investors who are very keen to take what we're doing and work with us.
I'm speaking to Ian Shapiro. He is the CEO of Real. In just a bit, we look at the financials of this charity and how they face a complaint that was lodged against them with the UK Charity Commission. Stay with us, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, this is the Breakfast Grill. I'm talking to Ian Shapiro, CEO of Real. Real is a charity whose mission is to provide affordable housing in Africa and Asia. Earlier, we talked about their unique model that uses local project partners and how they are funded. Ian, I spent some time looking at your annual report, and I know you only joined in February 2018. However, in the trustees report, they make reference to an anonymous complaint that led to an investigation by the UK Charity Commission. Can you tell us what this complaint was all about?
Absolutely. So there was a whistleblower allegation that dated back to 2017, which was investigated thoroughly by the UK Charity Commission, as quite rightly so. We take any whistleblower allegations extremely seriously, and we welcome any level of scrutiny. And we were pleased to have the UK Charity Commission come in and look at us. And we're very pleased to have gone through that investigation, that thorough scrutiny process with them, and concluded that the whistleblower allegations were unfounded and were there was nothing to them. So we were pleased to work with the Charity Commission to receive their report, which has made some useful suggestions about further strengthening governance, and which we now have an action plan which we're responding to thoroughly. But actually, in terms of the allegations that were made, they were all proved to be unfounded. But we welcome that kind of scrutiny, and yes.
But what were some of the allegations?
Well, some of it's difficult to go into because it referred to individuals, and all of those allegations were thoroughly scrutinized and proved to be unfounded. So I don't really want to add fuel to the fire, if that's all right, Xiaoning. But to say that obviously any allegations should be thoroughly investigated, they were, and a clean bill of health was provided.
And is this in any way related to why your two big funders, the UK Department for International Development and the Swedish International Development Cooperation Agency, held back their funding in 2018 and were cautious in their disbursements to Real?
Well, obviously, you would expect any investor to be concerned about a whistleblower allegation and want to check that out. And obviously, both of those agencies were thoroughly involved in the scrutiny and the review themselves, and also concluded a satisfactory outcome. So absolutely, that's a sensible investor decision to look at an organization, to take any allegation seriously. But as we say, we're very pleased to have been through that process and been given a clean bill of health, and pleased to have new investment provided, and looking forward to helping solve some of the challenges of global urbanization.
And your chairman's report also makes reference, like you mentioned earlier, strengthening systems across the portfolio. And there's this 8-step assurance framework, which I guess is related to this anonymous complaint. Give us some color on this assurance framework.
So it's a key piece of how we look at the selection process for each investment. So, as we were talking about, the global challenges here are enormous. So we need to be very targeted and specific to ensure that we're demonstrating proof of concept. So we have an 8-step assurance framework, which starts by identifying countries of operation, understanding whether the conditions are such where our model could work, and then looking at individual partners, and then going on to looking at the health of an individual partner, and then at each individual investment proposition, followed by thorough ongoing monitoring, auditing, independent assurance assessment, and so on. So it's a cyclical starting from the country context down into the individual investment.
Because I think you did suffer some losses in South Africa, right, where you had to write off some £1 million. Is that related to also how you relook at how you choose your local partners?
So I think, Xiaoning, it's inevitable that we're going to have across our portfolio, some of our portfolio will not be always at the highest performing level. I think that if every one of our investments was extremely high performing and delivering huge returns, I don't think there would be a need for us as an organization. The market would have already addressed the problem. People would have come in and commercially responded to that opportunity. We've got a high risk appetite, but a very low tolerance for a zero tolerance for fraud and corruption and financial due diligence. So we absolutely operate in a high-risk environment, and that means that every investment won't work. And as long as we're learning swiftly from that and able to adapt to it, then that's the kind of life-changing opportunities that we've provided for so many people.
So you have people on the ground in each of the countries you operate in to do the due diligence before you choose a local partner?
So absolutely. So there's always a visits by, so we're based in the UK, but there's regular visiting, monitoring, and evaluation by both ourselves, and we have third party independent monitoring that we do as well to make sure we get a rounded assessment of every investment that we're delivering.
You know, there's this other thing about the currency losses, right, which you mentioned earlier, and there were significant losses of about £7.6 million in 2018. Is there any way to address this better? I just wonder.
So, Xiaoning, I mean, if you have some ability yourself to understand and predict global currency crisis, I'm very keen for us to have a conversation about it off air.
That's true.
You can help me with that.
Yeah, currency fluctuation is so volatile.
It is, and again, we're operating in complicated markets. We know that. We recognise that we don't want to put all of that burden onto our local partners who are often delivering very innovative, dynamic work, reaching some of the poorest people in the world with housing and quality services, and trying to demonstrate something incredibly complicated, both in terms of land titling and so on. And we recognise that that currency fluctuates in that environment. And at the moment, our investment is in hard currency where we receive our investment. So we try to manage it. Our conclusion so far is that often hedging is disproportionately expensive to the risks of the currency fluctuation. But you're right, it's a risk, and we factor it into the model.
And unfortunately, it's the cost of doing business in these countries, right? The hedging cost is very high.
Exactly. And often the state of the financial capital markets aren't always in a position where there's a viable alternative to dealing with the currency exchange. Sometimes you benefit from exchange rate losses and sometimes you don't. And that's, as you say, the cost of doing business.
And I also looked at your annual report, and I see that expenditure actually has gone up for your charity, in particular salaries and wages. They've increased by 30% in 2018 from 2017, and in a year where income fell by 20%. And there's been some focus on how charities spend their money and how much is actually dispersed, right?
So I think it's always, I mean, you're right, Shanning. I mean, as a charity, I mean, even though we run on with a business model, clearly it's absolutely essential to make sure that everything we do is targeted on reaching the end beneficiary, that the female-headed household we were talking about earlier, living in a concreted floor with a curtain in a room, that's the person that you need to think about as she goes about her daily life, what that investment needs to get to her. Equally, you need to make sure you've got the right level of robust systems and scrutiny. And so we've been operating on a very, very, very skeletal staff model. And as we expand and realize the interests from other investors and the demand of what we do, we have had a salary increase, but still it's a pretty small level in terms of the overall cost. It's a very small percentage compared to any comparable charity.
And finally, since you were here in Kuala Lumpur recently, are you planning to start a real initiative in Malaysia? Because affordable housing is one of our major issues, and we have a long list, you know, corruption, education system, amongst others.
Right. I was in Malaysia a couple of weeks ago, and there's a lot of people with interest. And clearly this is a challenge. You know, you're already a fairly urban country compared to some of your neighbours. The urban growth rate is high. You know, there's over 500,000 more people living in urban centres in Malaysia each year. So that means that the listeners, as they take their commute perhaps this morning, there's another 61 people living in urban areas in Malaysia just in the last hour. Or if you're in Kuala Lumpur, just in the last hour, there's another 27 people who call Kuala Lumpur home. So you think about that expansion level and the rates of the need for affordable housing, and you look at the housing rate now of the median home in Malaysia is about $75,000. We would be encouraging that, you know, to look at the much lower end of that and bring down the price point. So there are people interested in us. I think that in many senses, Malaysia's a little further ahead of the curve than a number of other countries. But if someone was particularly interested in looking at Malaysia, clearly there's a case to be made.
Thank you, Ian, for being on The Breakfast Grill. I hope the next time you speak, Real will be close to changing the lives of 100 million people in Africa and Asia, and the concept of patient capital takes flight. I'm Wong Xiaoning for The Morning Run, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile. Now with faster speeds every day. Barula Bes.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.